From the halls of every school in Michigan, this is School Talks on 760 WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy. Sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran, Real Point, Collins and Plaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, Clark Construction, and by Must Construction Careers. Now, take your seats. Class is in session. Here's Robert.
This week on the program, we will enter the world of vape, and we have a power-packed lineup of guests, including Jade Cruz, the Prevention Program Manager for Care of Southeastern Michigan, Dr. Glenn Maleko, Superintendent of Dearborn Schools, Dr. Charlene McGunn, the Executive Director of the Chippewa Valley Coalition for Youth and Families, and rounding out the program, we have Dr. Javier Diaz-Mendoza, the Fellowship Director for Pulmonary and Critical Care at Henry Ford Hospital. All this and more coming up. This is School Talks on 760 WJR.
This is School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now on the program is Jade Cruz, Prevention Program Manager for Care of Southeastern Michigan. Welcome to the program, Jade.
Thanks for having me.
So in our continued focus on vape and its effect on children, in your experience, what age groups and schools are typically using vape?
Yeah, it's pretty broad. It's much broader than I think people really tend to think or want to believe. We tend to think it's a high school age person picking up a vape, but it's actually upper elementary, middle school that we're seeing an increase in vape use.
So upper elementary, we're talking 10, 11, 12-year-olds?
Yeah, at least a decade before the legal age.
And in your experience working with children and families, what effect does older family members who use vape have on children?
Yeah, something that we've seen across districts is the family norm of nicotine use, whether that's grandma and grandpa, aunt, uncle, cousins, siblings, parents. And so the understanding of, is it safe? If it's safe for mom and dad, it must be safe for me. And so there is that shift that we're seeing as it's more and more acceptable among family members.
And, you know, we've talked on this program before about the whole normalization of it, given its accessibility and so on. And have you, in the children that you've worked with, do you have a sense of how many you think are fully addicted? Is there a way to understand that?
Yeah, it's difficult because every kid that I talk to says, oh, I can quit whenever I want, right? That's the, sure. This self-importance, and I applaud that confidence. But I think that the understanding truly is that nicotine addiction can onset as early as days or weeks. So if you've got a youth who's hanging out every weekend at a friend's house picking up their friend's vape, that addiction can onset pretty early or pretty quickly.
Sure. And, you know, given the addictive nature of nicotine, as you mentioned, how does the amount of it in a single vape pen compare to a traditional number of cigarettes, like in a pack?
Yeah, so I use the Breeze Pro as kind of like my default, but we know that there's thousands of different vape products. And, you know, the 5% can be pretty ambiguous for users. So I break it down for youth in terms of nicotine quantity. So if we really think about it, there's on average 25 to 30 cigarettes worth of nicotine in one Breeze Pro or vape product. And that's just for one. So imagine like a 12-year-old smoking a pack or a pack and a half a week. You know, when you start to think about it in that way, it can be pretty disheartening to understand the situation in that way.
And given the one you mentioned, the Breeze Pro, is that one of the pens that has the refillable cartridge?
That's just a disposable. So it's a one, once it's done, once the battery's died or the juice is gone, then it would be disposed of.
So not only is the addictive nature front and center, the portability of it. Mm-hmm. We've talked with many school leaders about the challenge of vape in schools and the problem it creates. And just given the concealability of it. I mean, many of these things look like an old-fashioned USB drive. You would never know, unless you're a trained professional, that this is actually containing vape. Have you had much experience with children who are vaping but unknowingly crossing over into the drug aspect like THC and whatnot?
Yeah, so statistically we know that addiction, the dopamine pathways that someone might use for nicotine is similar to THC, alcohol, and other drugs. That pathway is super important, especially in adolescent development. So the same pathways that a youth is being rewarded with nicotine is the same as THC. And youth who pick up nicotine in those developmental years are more than three times as likely to pick up THC or marijuana. So we know those two things are very interrelated.
And truly, the term gateway is a shining example here.
Yeah, I don't like to use that term, but yes, it's very valid.
Tell me, why not?
I think I get a lot of eye rolls from the kids when I mention like a gateway drug, and they tend to kind of roll it off their shoulders. So I personally just try and avoid that term in general.
Probably feels too parental, like you're talking.
Yeah, yeah, there. Unrelatable.
Sure. So we're currently with Jade Cruz, the Prevention Program Manager for CARE of Southeastern Michigan, talking about vape and its effect on children. So in the spirit of nicotine and whatnot, how does the ingredients in a vape with respect to carcinogens compared to nicotine, and how does that all intersect with the Federal Drug Administration and their regulation of the manufacture of vape? Mm-hmm. How does that all intersect?
Yeah, it's a broad issue, right? When we look at the ingredients of a vape, there might be five or six items on there, some being like propylene glycol or vegetable glycerin. And then they've got the ambiguous terms of things like flavor, artificial flavors, and nicotine. And with the manufacturing being mostly all of these, or most of these products are created in China and then brought over to the U.S. And so the definition of artificial flavors is really not reported. And for the FDA, they've only approved 23 vapes to be sold in the United States. But we know that's not being reflected when we go to the gas station, right? We know there's sometimes hundreds of vape products being sold. So there is no FDA-approved vape product currently. And so I really push that with youth to understand that, you know, the Food and Drug Administration doesn't recognize that this is a safe product for any age group.
Mm-hmm. You know, in my time as superintendent, our district was one of a few who joined a lawsuit that actually sued vape manufacturers for targeting children. And it all centered around flavorings, mm-hmm. right? We actually prevailed in this lawsuit along with it. It was one of those large class action lawsuits, but it really put a focus on how children have been targeted with flavorings. And in your experience, what problems does flavoring create for children, especially as it relates to additives and whatnot, and its long-term effect on their health?
Yeah. Well, one, it's a huge draw for children. You have to think, if it were a menthol or tobacco-flavored vape, they probably wouldn't pick that up. So one, it's a huge draw. And two, we know that some flavorings contain a chemical called diacetyl, and that is linked to bronchitis obliterans, which is permanent scarring of the lung tissue. There's really no treatment for that, mm-hmm. aside from maybe, you know, like a lung transplant or terminal illness. And so flavoring in itself, as big of a draw as it is to youth, it is really, really concerning for such a young person mm-hmm. to be faced with detrimental health issues.
Is that the term they refer to as popcorn lung?
Yes. Yep.
The way, what it does to the lung tissue and whatnot.
Yeah, diacetyl, actually, the way that it came about was it's in flavored popcorn, so that's where it gets its name.
Wow. So following up on that, does, in your experience with children, do you feel that the use of vape has any particular psychological effect? I know we talked about the physiological, but how are children presenting themselves to you from a psychological perspective when you're talking to them about using vape?
Yeah, a huge portion of what we talk about in our programming is why they might start. A huge portion of that is, well, I use because I'm depressed or anxious or stressed, but we're not seeing those things go down as a result of nicotine use. And so we know that it's a Band-Aid, especially because dopamine is being released every time they hit that pen. And so it's a very temporary fix for, you know, a pretty serious problem. So we do see that it's not necessarily helping, but it could also be making those mental illnesses worse.
Just exacerbate them to the mm-hmm. highest degree possible.
As if kids aren't dealing with enough these days.
No question. So Jade Cruz, Prevention Program Manager for CARE of Southeastern Michigan. You have given our School Talks listeners some really important and relevant information as it relates to vape and especially its effect on children. I appreciate your time and most importantly, keep up the good work.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Coming up after the break, we'll have Superintendent of Dearborn Schools, Dr. Glenn Maleko. Stay right there. We'll be back right after this.
This is School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy, sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran, Real Point, Collins and Plaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, Clark Construction, and by Must Construction Careers. Once again at the head of the class, Dr. Livernoy.
Joining us now on the program is Superintendent Glenn Maleko from Dearborn Public Schools, and he's joined by Danielle El-Zayat, Dearborn's Director of Health, Safety, and Security. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dr. Livernoy. Thanks for having us.
Appreciate it very much. So many of us are very much aware of how much a problem vaping has become for adolescents as they try to address the challenges of being an adolescent and so on. Many of them turn to substance abuse and use, and vaping has become, in my experience and talking with my colleagues, an extraordinary challenge for public schools. And we're joined today by Superintendent Maleko and Director El-Zayat to talk about Dearborn's decision to install vape detectors in their school bathroom. So, Superintendent Maleko, tell us what prompted the decision for you to install these vape detectors.
So, as you said, Bob, it's you know, it's been a national problem, state problem, and all over. We're seeing it where students are. It's an addiction, and you know, we felt we need to do something to support our students. Now, years ago, I was told about these vape detectors, and then they were not given a very good grade as to their performance. So, I've kind of held off. My team here in Dearborn, we've been holding off. Recently. Last year, I was talking to Superintendent Katie Makowski, who's the current MASA superintendent president, and she's like, I had these vape detectors in the system that really works well. And so it's kind of the superintendent's sharing in information. And so she got in contact with me, and I got her in contact with Danielle, and then we found out that they really are effective, and we decided to then pilot it at one of the schools, again, really looking to help the students as our main objective.
And I assume, what are some of the primary goals of implementing the detectors within the school? What do you hope to achieve by it?
So one of the things I would just say is that we know it's an addiction, and so we want to get help for students. That's important, right? So that's kind of where we're taking it from. But at the same token, we want to prevent, especially in the bathrooms, this seems to be, you know, a soft spot in the school where students tend to go and vapes can occur. We also know, like, we found when we've had some plumbing issues at one of our high schools where, you know, the vapes were the issue in the plumbing because they were thrown down the toilet. And so we wanted to provide a process to it really to enforce not only with the students that are vaping, but to make it safe for those that are not vaping and respect their rights. And so we just thought we need to do whatever we can to help students. So then if a student is identified, it's not just a disciplinary consequence. It's how can we help you to get help so that you understand this is not good for your health.
Mm-hmm. And Danielle El-Zayat, Director of Health, Safety, and Security for Dearborn School. How does this vape detection process align with the district's broader approach to student safety and well-being?
Good morning. Thank you. That's a great question. As Dr. Maleko alluded to, this was twofold. We wanted to help students who may be on the pipeline to addiction, and we wanted to help them with their addiction to nicotine and anything else that can be smoked through the vape detector. We also wanted to help students feel safe, those students who are not vaping, using the restrooms. We were receiving complaints that students didn't feel safe going to use the restroom because other students would be in there vaping. So with the research and with the information that Dr. Maleko received from the other superintendent, you know, we piloted the program to see if it would work as a deterrent, and the data has shown that it does work as a deterrent. When the vape detectors were first installed, the vape detectors were going off I'd say around 50 times a day. That has definitely significantly decreased where the vape detectors may go off a few times a day. Mm-hmm. So that right there is proof that the vape detectors are working as a deterrent.
And on a broader scale, as you take this to scale in the district, how are locations for the vape detectors chosen?
So when students were caught vaping, the number one place that they were caught vaping was in the bathrooms. So that's why we made the decision to put a vape detector in every single bathroom in the high school.
Okay, so, and you mentioned the reduction in the number of times the alerts have gone off since you installed them. How is the detection system monitored, and who's responsible for responding when there is an alert from one of the detectors?
So the detector is mounted on the ceiling in every restroom. Once it is alerted that somebody is vaping inside of the bathroom, an alert, which is the Halo vape software that comes with the vape detector, an alert is sent to whoever the school decides. So in our buildings, the administrators receive an alert, and then the administrators then communicate to the security team and assistant principals that somebody is in whatever bathroom was identified vaping. So the vape detector goes off in the restrooms, security is alerted, they go to the restroom, and, you know, they question the students that are there vaping in the school.
And, you know, in concept, it's very similar to the panic bar on an emergency exit door. Not only does it make a sound, but it certainly alerts people to an open door in the school. So we're currently joined by Glenn Maleko and Danielle Elzayat from Dearborn Schools, talking about vaping and the detection systems they have installed in the district. And Superintendent Maleko, what is the district's policy for handling a student who is caught after an alert is triggered?
So obviously, as Ms. Elzayat mentioned, you know, the main thing is we need to, first of all, determine who it is, depending on who's in the bathroom. I've actually spoken to, I have a student, superintendent student advisory council, and that's an issue that the students have brought up to me is, well, what if they're in there when there's other students doing it and somebody gets caught and it's not them? And so we kind of went over a process that what will happen is the assistant principals or the principals would investigate it. They'll question the students and then make a determination. And then a lot of times, you know, the consequence could be, it could be disciplinary consequences in the school. It's illegal to have it in the school. Students could get ticketed, but really we're, it's not just the enforcement, it's to try to seek counseling for the students to get help. So that's why once they're identified, they also reach out to make sure they can get support with the addiction.
How are you educating students and staff, not only about the vape detectors and the policies surrounding them, but also how are they receiving the presence of the detectors, especially parents?
I think it's been very positive, and that was one of the other factors as to why I wanted to bring in the vape detectors. And I even at one point, my team was, my cabinet team was kind of like hesitant, are we sure we want to do it? I'm like, yes, we do, because we need to do whatever we can to support the parents and the community. And the parents knew it was a problem as well. So we've generally gotten really positive within the parents and the community. As I mentioned, I have my advisory council of students, and I've kind of gotten positive responses from them as well. And then, you know, I have superintendents. I'm on the MASA Superintendent Association Board for the state of Michigan, and we just had our conference a couple weeks ago. Literally, multiple superintendents saw the headline of what we're doing with vapes, and they have contacted us. And now what's happening is they want to meet with us to find out, you know, how are they working, what are we doing to implement this effective model. So generally, it's been extremely positive. I've heard no negative feedback as to the implementation of this program.
And as this grows in popularity, a question for Danielle Elzayat is, what is the cost of purchasing and installing the detectors, and where is your project funded from?
So we use the Halo vape detector, and the cost is roughly $2,100 per detector, and the cost was funded by our general funds, and we thought it was very, very cost-effective because it not only works as a vape detector, but also it works as an aggression detector, a shot detector. So there are other health, safety, life-saving things that the monitor actually picks up.
That's some fantastic work going on in Dearborn Public Schools. I would like to thank you, Superintendent Glenn Maleko, and the Director of Health, Safety, and Security, Danielle El-Zayat, for joining us today and sharing with us your work on installing vape detectors in schools. I appreciate your time, and as always, keep up the good work.
Thanks a lot, Dr. Livernois. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
Thank you.
After a word from our sponsors, we'll hear from Dr. Charlene McGunn. Stay right there. This is 760 WJR.
School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernois.
Joining us now in the program is the Executive Director of the Chippewa Valley Coalition for Youth and Families, Dr. Charlene McGunn. Welcome to the program, Charlene.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time. In our continued focus on School Talks, discussing vaping and addiction and all the challenges it poses for children, tell us a little bit about the mission of the Chippewa Valley Coalition for Youth and Families and sort of what your primary goals are.
Well, the official mission statement of the coalition is that we join families. We joined the Chippewa Valley Schools, parents, and the community in promoting healthy, resilient, and drug-free youth. And another focus is the prevention of youth suicide. Mm-hmm. So those are our primary focus.
And among all of this great work that you're doing, could you point to an initiative or a strategy that you're using that has been the most impactful in the community?
Probably the general strategy of the education of the effects of youth use of all substances, vaping, marijuana, alcohol, and other substances, and the effects on youth, academic, mental health, as well as behavioral. The idea that youth use really derails the development of children and adolescents has come through to us as a message that seems to have been received. And that's the continued message that we send as part of our strategies.
And, you know, I'm very much aware of your coalition, having worked in the county for many years, and I couldn't agree with you more that the impact you're making is making a difference. And I'm curious, what inspired you to dedicate your career to youth and family advocacy, and how has your background help you with this coalition?
Well, my background is social work and clinical psych, and in working with youth across a few areas, including working in the schools and working clinically with youth and their families, I've seen the effects of youth use of substances on children and adolescents themselves, as well as their families. And it's a very real and concerning effect. So that has really been a central focus for me across much of the work that I've done.
And, you know, given the pervasiveness of vape, what are some of the most significant challenges and equally successes that you can point to during your time in the coalition?
The challenge, I think, is for some youth, the normalization of vaping. The other challenge is the quick addiction to vaping, because nicotine is such a addictive substance, if that's what they're vaping. Mm-hmm. And marijuana is an addictive substance. Another substance that's vaped, it creates real challenges in addressing the realities of youth vaping. Youth become, as well as adults actually, become very quickly addicted to vape substances. And I guess if there are successes we can point to, it has been the engagement of our coalition teen councils in strategies at our schools, where they at Chippewa Valley and Dakota High School, where they bring forth messages about the dangers of vaping. Also, we are seeing a decline in vaping that is in line with national data, mm-hmm. and that is while vaping is still high, we are seeing declines being sustained since COVID, and that's very good news.
That is very good news. We're currently joined by Executive Director of the Chippewa Valley Coalition for Youth and Families, Dr. Charlene McGunn. So, Dr. McGunn, a follow-up. Given all this great work that you're doing, are there any new collaborations in the works that you're excited to share with us as it relates to continuing this good work?
Well, we were fortunate to recently receive a grant from the Jamie Daniels Foundation, and that is moving us forward in an area that we're very interested in, and that is downreach to parents of elementary age students to educate them on the issues of youth use, that in a few years their children will be in middle school and high school and will be facing the challenges of peer use. And it is going to fund the creation of materials that we will be using to educate our parents, our elementary parents. All of those materials, by the way, as well as all that we create, are available on our website.
Mm-hmm. And if I could add, just in my experience watching your coalition work, one of the most successful things that it does well is your persistence. In education, we're really good at starting things, and often the challenge of sustaining them becomes an issue. But this coalition has been at the forefront. I can remember the role it played when the legalization of marijuana was on the ballot in Michigan, and the campaign that Chippewa led to make sure people understood the longitudinal and long-term effects it will have on children. And sadly, we're actually experiencing the very thing that you and others in the coalition predicted. And if you were to give advice to other organizations or communities looking to replicate what you're doing, what would you tell them?
Well, I would suggest to any coalition that is attempting to build its strength and capacity to continue to engage all sectors of the community, to bring to the table everyone whose mission is to support youth, certainly school districts, the school district in your area. We're very, very well supported by Chippewa Valley Schools, and that's been part of our success, but also to bring to the table parents, law enforcement, community agencies, churches, the court system, the health department, community mental health. Those entities and more have been part of have contributed greatly, I think, to our ability to educate the community as well as to create strategies to address youth use.
And, you know, if there's ever an example of all hands on deck, this is one of them. I appreciate your recognizing how important all of those sectors are in an initiative and a movement such as this. So Dr. Charlene McGunn, Executive Director of the Chippewa Valley Coalition for Youth and Families, I want to thank you for your time today. And as always, keep up the good work with the coalition, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Bob.
Coming up after the break, we'll be joined by Dr. Javier Diaz-Mendoza, who will help us understand the dangerous effects of vape. Stay right there. We'll be back right after this.
Talks on WJR is sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran, Real Point, Collins and Plaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, Clark Construction, and by Must Construction Careers. Now let's get back to class. Once again, your host, former Superintendent Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now from Henry Ford Hospital is the Fellowship Director of Pulmonary and Critical Care, Dr. Javier Diaz-Mendoza. Welcome to the program, Doctor.
Thank you very much, Dr. Livernoy. Thank you for the invitation today.
This program is dedicated to looking at vape and the effects it has on adolescents and people in general, just given how pervasive it is in our schools. And what I'd like to start with, in your experience in pulmonary care, what are some of the common lung issues you're seeing in patients who vape?
Well, what I usually see as part of my work is I work in the intensive care unit. And one of the most common lung issues that I get to see there is patients with EVALI. EVALI stands for e-cigarette vaping acute lung injury. So I tend to see these patients more often than what I see patients with chronic effects.
So this is sort of an urgent onset of a problem, hence the term acute, right? It's almost like an injury to the lungs. Is that right?
That's correct. So in general, the effect of e-cigarette of vaping could be divided in two. One is the acute effect, sort of like fast happening effect, that it could happen even during the first time that the person is exposed to e-cigarettes, or could be during the 10th time or the 100th time or the 1,000th time. But it's an effect that is very acute. It happens within hours or days. And this is called EVALI, which is, again, e-cigarette vaping acute lung injury. And then the other type of effect of doing vaping is a chronic effect. And these are usually effects that have to do with repetitive exposure to all the contents that come from vaping, and they could lead eventually to conditions like cancer, bronchiolitis obliterans, which is an inflammatory lung condition, or heavy metal lung disease, among others. So there could be other diseases that are related to a chronic exposure to e-cigarettes or vaping. However, we don't have enough data yet since e-cigarettes have been around in the United States since 2006. But it's highly likely that as years come and as more people get exposed to it, we may find associations between e-cigarettes smoking and lung diseases.
Mm-hmm. You know, and in my time in schools, we regularly battled the misconception on the part of students, and in many cases their parents, that somehow vaping is safer than smoking cigarettes. And could you talk a little bit about what some of the chemicals are in these vape products that are particularly harmful to the lungs?
And that is a great question, because that's how vaping was introduced initially, as to be safer than smoking, but it's actually not. Mm-hmm. There are, as you mentioned, different chemicals, and I'm just going to mention some of them. One, obviously nicotine, that is a highly addictive substance that affects the brain development and produces this sensation of pleasure in the brain, and when the brain does not get it, then the brain craves nicotine. Other substances that are part of the vaping, or that are seen and that are actually found in vaping, are, for example, propylene glycol. This is actually a substance that is used to make antifreeze or paint solvent. So imagine that gets into the lung and into your body in general as from absorption, then it could be detrimental. Substances like acetaldehyde or formaldehyde that could lead to cancer can also be found in e-cigarettes. Acrolein, which is used in herbicides and used to kill weeds, also is found in e-cigarettes and could lead to inflammation and damage of the lungs. Diacetyl is a chemical that causes bronchiolitis obliterans and also, as I said, could also cause inflammation of the lungs. Diethylene glycol is a chemical that is used for antifreeze as well, that is found in e-cigarettes. Heavy metals like nickel, tin, or lead also are found in e-cigarettes and lead to heavy metal lung diseases that eventually lead to pulmonary fibrosis or scar tissue of the lungs. other substances like cadmium or benzene are also found in e-cigarettes. Ultra-fine particles that can be inhaled deep into the lungs also. So in general, you know, there's a rule, and the rule is the only thing that should enter the lungs is air. Now, any other substance that enters the lung has the capacity to lead to lung damage. Now, we already are exposed to other things like pollution, for example, that we cannot control. But this is something that we can control for sure.
Yes. So we're currently with Dr. Javier Diaz-Mendoza, a pulmonologist with Henry Ford Hospital, talking about the dangers and damage that happens when you vape. And let me ask you, Doctor, given our continued focus on all things related to schools, how does vaping impact the lung development in adolescents and young adults, given their age and the use of the product?
Right. So by the time of we are youth or adults, the lungs have completely developed. The only thing that happens with the lungs as we age in general, since we're kids until adults and then grow older, is they grow in size. So the maximum lung function that we achieve during our lives, we achieve it around by the age of 30. From then, all our function in the lungs start decreasing with age. So my own lung function will start coming down and down after the age of 30. Now, if a person is exposed to substances like e-cigarettes or any other substances that get into the lungs that damage the lungs, like, for example, e-cigarettes, before the age of 30, then that person will never achieve the maximum capacity of the lungs. And this will definitely affect how the lungs continue to evolve and continue to decline on their capacity just because of age. So definitely these persons can develop these chronic lung conditions, and that could lead even to the point that they may require oxygen down the road. But so that's more or less the idea of what exposure to e-cigarettes could have, could actually have.
Dr. Javier Diaz-Mendoza, pulmonologist and fellowship director of pulmonary and critical care at Henry Ford Hospital, I appreciate your expertise, your concern, and your continued work in helping people in the vape community. I appreciate your time today, and keep up the good work. A very special thanks to our guests today, Jade Cruz, Dr. Glenn Maleko, Dr. Charlene McGunn, and Dr. Javier Diaz-Mendoza for helping us explore and examine the world of vape and the incredibly dangerous effects it has on children. That's all the time we have for today. But remember, there are two ways to spell one and three ways to spell two. Till next time, this has been School Talks on 760 WJR.